Welcome to CFO 4.0, the future of finance. The CFO role is changing rapidly, moving from cost controller to strategic visionary. And with every change comes opportunity. We are here to help you take advantage of this transition, to win at work, drive your career forwards, and lead with confidence. Join Hannah Munro, Managing Director of ITAS, a financial transformation consultancy, as she interviews key experts to give you real-world advice and guidance on how to transform your processes, people, and data. Welcome to CFO 4.0, the future of finance.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of CFO 4.0. With me today is a special guest. I think one of the youngest CFOs in the UK. I'm really excited to say we've got Sophia Lavelle, who is the CFO of Access Fertility, joining me on today's show. So welcome, Sophia. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to being here.
So you've got the title of the UK's youngest CFO. So let's just start with, what was your journey into the role?
So I think I always knew I wanted to be an accountant from a really young age. Basically, this one day I went to PwC offices when I was at college. And I remember walking through the door and thinking, I'm going to run this office one day. So I actually dropped out of college and just started working and did my finance studies. And I was just so desperate to do it as fast as I could. I would sit like two exams every quarter, all first-time passes. And then I would move jobs quite quick as well if I felt like I wasn't progressing. So in summary, that was sort of the journey to get there, was just like determination to be the best CFO and accountant I could be. And then before I knew it, I was 28 and a CFO. And I was like, wow, okay, what now? I'm on my
And tell me a little bit about, you know, that transition, I guess, from like finance operator to CFO. How did you see that transition?
I think one of the main things was also my environment at the time. So I grew up originally in Birmingham. I'm London based now, but in Birmingham. And in Birmingham, I would say commerciality isn't really taught, or entrepreneurial, like it isn't really taught or spoke about. But I was very lucky. I had an opportunity just after I became sort of like a finance director to work in a firm where I worked alongside the CEO and the founder. And they really opened my eyes up to the strategic parts of a business more. And it was from there I thought a CFO is where I'm meant to be, because I obviously have the commercial and financial knowledge behind me. And this is the route I need to go down. And it was that role that allowed me to transition from that. I think if you don't have exposure to the board and the almost like the brain of the people running the business, it's quite hard to transition because it's like self-learning, but you learn so much from other people. I would like definitely recommend like a mentor or someone like that who sits at that level to teach you how to transition.
Tell us a little bit about those key learnings during that time. What, I guess, how did it change how you operate and how you think about things, having that exposure to that sort of top level C-suite strategy piece?
I think for me, sort of the main lessons were, you know, I think when you're an operator, it's easy to think that, oh my gosh, this is like a really big deal and it's going to change everything. But it doesn't. You have to see things from a much bigger view. So it's almost like, don't sweat the small stuff. But it made me think that you do need operators. So I have always known that I'm not a really good operator. It's like, I've got ADHD, my admin is really bad. So I was always very like creative. And it taught me that the biggest asset is the staff you have below you to then be able to do that work for you. And just other things, I guess, it's like you're not looking tomorrow, you're looking 5 years ahead and how you're going to get there. And the biggest thing is probably like mitigating risk, the risk around things as a business, whether that be authoritative risk or, you know, market risk. They're things you don't see or think about as an operator. So they were probably the biggest lessons as being, you know, transitioning across.
And tell me a little bit about, I guess, that team aspect to it. Because you obviously mentioned that you find a team that is complementary, I guess, to your skills. How do you think about building out that team?
Well, I would definitely say I learned the hard way. I definitely, when I first started managing staff, I would hire staff that were exactly like me, because it was almost like the personality hires. I'd be like, oh my gosh, you got on with this person so well. We're going to have such a good time. We're going to bounce off each other. But really, I wasn't very good at micromanaging those people that probably needed micromanaging. I was always a bit more step back, because that's how I'd always sort of been managed. And then I found that things got messy and things got missed. And obviously, I'm completely accountable for that. So then when I stepped into teams where I had operators, even if they weren't the biggest personality, they got the job done and made my life easier. And obviously, I then brought them a different perspective of how they can view things. So that's sort of what I really look for now, is someone who can actually just do the job. Obviously, and a nice person. I think that's probably the main thing when building out a team.
And that's an interesting piece about management style. So when you're bringing people on, has that changed how you evaluate how they like to be managed? Because it's an interesting piece, isn't it? Everyone manages slightly differently. So how much of that actually do you talk about in your recruitment process?
A lot, because it is very, very important. I wouldn't say I'm very good at micromanaging, because one of my weaknesses is organization. So I'm good at what I do, but obviously it can be quite organized chaos. It's like I need someone to manage me in that way and say, this is written, this, like, we need to get this ticked off or this tax paid or whatnot. So if I'm going to hire someone who I know I'm going to have to micromanage, it just isn't a good fit. So it's just, yeah, I definitely am. And I'm open about that on interviews, but I've done so many interviews, you can sort of tell. It's usually the people who need to be micromanaged are usually the big personalities. So that's sort of what I've found so far.
Yeah. And what else, you know, when you're evaluating, I guess, cultural fit for you and the team, what are some of the things that you think about?
Someone who is going to get on with the team, I think. Different roles require different skill sets and different personalities. I would never hire maybe people with an ego, just because I think they might rub off wrong on other people. I mean, we've all got an ego, but I'm just very careful. And then, but obviously an ego works brilliant if you're in sales. But it's like, it's just managing, yeah, that personality really. And if I have a team, who is going to fit in with the team? Because you don't want someone to come into the team and completely disrupt them. So yeah, it's sort of managing that as well.
And obviously stepping up into managing a team, like, I, you know, very often the conversations I have on the podcast is like, actually managing a team can be incredibly difficult whilst trying to step into your new role as a CFO and FD. You know, how do you think, you know, why do you think you've been successful in terms of managing the team? What lessons did you learn along the way?
I would create almost a door to you. So what I mean by that is you have a team leader of the team, because it's very hard. If you have 10 staff under you or 20 staff directly under you, your full-time job is managing people, managing holidays, managing sickness, which isn't really a part of your role and can take so much time. So what I always try and do is bring in the people one level below me who can deal with that and manage that stuff. And it's usually really good, because it also creates a pathway for progression within the different teams, because you never want people to think they've hit a ceiling and then move on. So it's just creating structure in those teams to make your life easier. And, you know, there's people who are better at managing individual teams like that than I am, because I don't have the time to. So, but always make sure you're still always available to people. If they will need to come and ask you questions, that's obviously non-negotiable. But yeah, that's probably the way I found it best to do it for me.
And in terms of, you know, what do you think one of the, you know, when it comes to what you've achieved, what do you say are your biggest successes? What are you most proud of?
I think just becoming a CFO so young. I always knew I was ahead of the curve when I was studying, when I was progressing through my career. Like, I remember looking at my friends around me, and none of them were even working by the time I was sort of becoming like a finance manager and stuff like that. So I'm really proud of that. And it probably wasn't until I actually became a CFO that I realized how well I'd done. Because when you're in the journey, you're just pushing for the next thing, you don't look back. And it was actually other people who would say to me, oh my gosh, you're so young. Oh my gosh, you're so young. But obviously it's your normality, I guess. So I'm when I look back, I am really proud of that. And then my ACCA journey, I did it really, really fast. And like with all first time passes, I mean, I worked very, very hard, came up with social life for 18 months, but very proud of that as well. And to be honest, I'm just very proud of like the relationships I've made. I wouldn't say there's probably anyone in business that I've never not gone with. And I would hope that I've left a really good reputation everywhere I've gone. So that's always something to be proud of, that people would talk highly of you in rooms that you're not in.
Tell me a little bit about how you see the CFO role. What do you think is important when assessing whether somebody's doing a good job as a CFO?
I think the first thing is, if you talk to the CEO and what they know about the business and what they think they know is true, because if they've got it slightly wrong, then you know that the communication between the CFO and the CEO isn't that great. I think the pressure on being a CFO is really hard, because if the business isn't going well, you're the first person that gets looked at and is like, what is really going on? What the hell is going on here? What are you doing? And it's funny, because obviously it's not your fault personally if things are happening. So that's probably the first thing I look at, is how do the other SLT or SMT see the business? And then also just the people then below them, what do they feel is going on? Do they know what the CFO is doing? Because I've gone into roles where CFOs have exited prior to me, and the staff will say, well, we didn't know what they did. And I think that's not good either, because then your team doesn't know what they're working towards. So I think they're the telltale signs of someone who isn't doing the job as best they can.
So let's explore that a little bit more, because there's two really good points in there. So firstly, that relationship with the CEO, how much visibility do they have into how well the organization's performing? And then the second piece is that comms piece within the team. So we're going to start with the second bit first, and then we'll roll back around. So tell me a little bit about what good comms is with your finance team. How do you make sure that that information is flowing in the right direction? How do you approach that?
So I, in practical terms, will sit down with my team once or twice a week and tell them, one, what I'm working on, and ask them what they're working on as a team, even though I have individual chats as well. Because I think it's important that they know what you're doing, because there can sometimes be this perception of people in on a C-suite, nobody knows what they do. They just might see them like going out often or doing things. And you don't want to create that resentment where the team think that you're not working as hard as what they are. And it's also important to, one, for their progression, to know what you're working on so they could aspire to do it or whatnot. And they also know what to help you with. If I tell the team that I'm working on X, Y, and Z, usually I then have the team randomly send me messages or come and see me and say, oh, I was looking into this and it might help you with this. So it's just things like that really.
Yeah. And I guess in terms of that piece, how do you structure those meetings so that you get the relevant information across? You know, have you got a particular format that you use for those regular updates?
I think it's, the way I do it is I just sort of go in, list what I'm working on, ask questions to the team, oh, has this been done? Has that been done? And then open the floor to them and say, what are you doing? What do you need my help with? And we sort of go around and talk about it. But I also find on those calls as well, the team will talk to each other. I know they talk to each other anyway, but sometimes they're like, oh, actually, I need to ask about this. I need to ask about that. That's sort of, I would say how I structure the call.
Yeah. And, you know, when you think about how you prioritize what the team is working on, because that can be one of the challenges working at that C-suite level, is there's always a billion things that need to be worked on. How do you decide on what should be the priorities for this week? How do you balance, I guess, the strategic piece and moving that forwards with making sure that the day job is getting done?
Well, from the day job perspective, I'm very, very lucky. I have a very, very good team. So I know that the day job is getting done. I'm probably almost the issue there, where they're emailing me like, Sophia, can you just sign this off and then chase that? So then when we get on those calls, they're like, yeah, I'm waiting for you actually. But the day to day is, like I say, if you hire well, you are going to be blessed and you're going to be fine. From the strategic perspective, I would say, well, who's asking for the work and what's the result of the work? It's always good to look at quick wins. So what could I change right now or do right now? That's not going to take me too long, but it's going to just move the business forward or help the board understand something more at that point in time. But I guess it is just sort of, what is the board after, or any immediate threats are quite obvious. Obviously, get rid of those as fast as you can. But I find it's constant with strategic work. It's sort of like a project after a project after a project. That's sort of how it seems to roll, unless obviously things just throw themselves up. And I find with finance, when you tell someone something like the C-suite or the board, oh, I've just found out this, it's like, oh my gosh, we need to do something on it right now. People are very reactive to finance, and it doesn't always have to be like that. And then you find that everything seems to rush straight away, then it settles down. So I would say it's sort of managing that as well, and sort of reiterating with the board at the C-suite, we don't have to act on this right now. I'm just letting you know sort of what's going on. But the main thing I would say is don't start a new project till the old one's finished, or don't start something new until you finish something else. In other words, you will have like 80% projects done across everything, and that's not great.
And that's an interesting piece about almost managing the board reaction, right? Tell us a little bit about how you approach communicating bad news into the CEO and the board. You know, something comes up, you find something. How do you, I guess, de-escalate to give yourself that time to address the issue?
So first of all, I find out what the issue is and how it has become an issue. Because no matter if it's a certain individual's fault within my team or within the business, I'm accountable, and I expect that to be on me as a C-suite member, that I take the brunt of what's happening in the team. I would say honesty is key. It is scary, because sometimes I've had to go to the board and be like, I've made a mistake or I've missed this. And obviously you're sitting there thinking, oh my God, this is the worst thing in the world. I'm going to get fired. Nobody's going to want to talk, like, communicate with me anymore. They're going to think I'm not good at my job. But it isn't like that at all. Like, from day one, if you are constantly being honest with what is going on, what you're seeing, when these problems come up, because they know you care, because you've been managing problems and being honest about hard things since the day you started, they take it a lot better. I think it's the they don't really know what you're doing. They think you're doing a good job. You're sort of giving them like wishy-washy answers or telling them what they want to hear. And then something really bad hits the fan. Then they're like, well, what have you been doing this whole time to miss that? But if you're constantly in communication, then I think you just can't go wrong. I mean, I communicate to my COO and CEO over the tiniest little things. We'll just talk about it. So it's everyone across the C-suite knows what's going on all the time. And then if there is something major that comes up, it's sort of major to all of us, not just one knew about it and was hiding it. I think as long as you've got trust in a business or in any relationship, you're absolutely fine.
And is there a way that you communicate that? Have you found, I guess, different boards need information given in different ways? You know, how do you find the balance between waiting for a board meeting versus maybe ad hoc communications in between?
So honestly, I've worked in quite a few businesses at that level, and they're all different. Right now I have a really, really good relationship with our CEO and COO. So we're constantly, the three of us constantly talking. And I found that really beneficial. I enjoy it more. And also it makes them, if they think of something that could potentially be finance related and I might have to look into, they communicate it with me straight away as well, rather than sitting on it or trying to do it themselves. But I've also worked in boards where, or C-suites, where I haven't had great communication, or the C-suite will talk without myself. And then that's really hard then. So yeah, I would say that's sort of like, it's just trying to balance the different relationships across different boards. But my advice from learning all of it would be just to get the relationship going straight away and almost insert yourself into conversations, because you need to tell them how important it is that you know everything that's going on, because a lot of people don't think things are relevant to finance. But of course, everything is relevant to finance, because I'm going to see it wash through the numbers eventually, no matter what decision you make. So it's just, being a bit bossy, being a bit assertive and being like, no, I need to be in this room and have these conversations.
You mentioned you had a challenge with a particular, you know, C-suite where they were having conversations outside of finance. Did you manage to resolve that, or did you manage to get to a point where they were bringing you in? And if so, how did you do it?
Yes, I did. It was, that just happened to be quite a young C-suite. They were all relatively young, so they were probably inexperienced in being in the C-suite themselves as well. Yeah. Which was completely fair enough that they were in that situation. I think it's just constant communication. And it's also, you can't just have one line to the C-suite, as in one person you keep going through. You need to build the relationships with all of them. It's almost like chip at them away at all of them individually, and then they'll bring you in. But it is, it's sort of showing them the consequences of what happens when you're not involved. Because when you're saying, well, this is happening, but I didn't know it was happening, but you knew it was happening like 2 months ago, then it ultimately, everyone should be looking at themselves and at the C-suite as a whole as how best to do it. But I think for me, like, self-reflection and self-teaching is very important. Like, you should always look at your weaknesses, and, you know, if things aren't going right in a relationship, well, aren't they going right? It should fall on everyone as a C-suite. And to be honest, just sit them all down and say, look, what is going on here? We need to fix this. So yeah, just being assertive again, like, just put yourself
and direct to the point, I think, yeah, is how I would sum that. And I think sometimes that can be hard though, you know. Yeah. And I would say what's amazing is obviously you've done that at such a young age as well. So, you know, where did that confidence come from? Is that just who you are underneath, or is that something you've had to develop, that assertiveness and that directness?
To be honest, I remember my dad just always described me as a child as someone who couldn't be penned in. So I grew up racing professional motocross. So I had motocross coaches, and they would tell me what to do. And I'd be like, I'm not doing that. Like, my dad used to say, you were absolutely crazy. But ultimately, I did do it in the end. And then I think when that sort of transitioned into business, it was probably sort of like a naivety that helped as well, for a blessing or a curse, in the way of I would back chat people as because I started working when I was 16 17, that you cannot talk to people like that. But I would be like, why are you telling me to do that? And they're on the C-suite and I'm like an accounts assistant. And I think it was that naivety that helped me be assertive, and then I just sort of managed to define it and tidy it up as I got older to help, like, benefit me. Because I got into quite a bit of trouble when I was younger working in firms. I mean, never to the point of being sacked, but, you know, people would say, Sophia, you can't talk to people like that. But it is that naivety of actually not understanding how office culture works. But then I think the benefit was, because I was good at my job, I'm pushing to be better, I could get away with it in the way of being like, well, she's being honest, she's giving us her thoughts, and, you know, she's really intelligent and we should sort of listen. But you're trying to sort of build that up at the same time as sort of getting respect and whatnot. But yeah, that's sort of how I would say it. It just started with me being a naive 17-year-old thinking, oh, I can just talk to people how I want, and then just having to fine-tune it to actually be in a respectable way.
So it sounds like some of that is just part of who you are. But actually, the interesting is a bit about you tidying, you use the phrase tidying that up. So tell me, I guess, about your journey of almost developing yourself to the, you know, to have those conversations, but in the right way. So tell me a little bit about how you approach that.
I guess the stories behind it are almost like, you obviously learn when they haven't worked, when you've approached someone a certain way. And they've always been like, whoa, you can't talk to me like that. Even as I have got older, there are, you know, times when you quite clash with someone. And it's easy when you're younger to be, or when you have an ego, to be quite defensive and be like, well, no, I'm right. Because I think if you think you've got a good heart, you think, well, it doesn't matter how I'm asking you the question because I know I've got no bad intention behind it. But actually, I think as I just became, I maybe clash with people more or not as much. And I just hated that idea. I'd go home on an evening and think, oh my gosh, that was a really bad conversation. Like, why doesn't this person like me and want to talk to me? Yeah. I was like, it's actually on me to change. And it is sort of, and I do think that comes naturally as you get older as well. Like when you get into your later 20s, you are much better at managing other people's emotions because, you know, you're also dealing with people that can be like you, who might have a bit of an ego. And then it's like, well, if they were talking to me like that, how would I react? So it's sort of be letting people do their way and just sort of working around it, because ultimately, as much as I hate this, there is a game that you have to play. And if it means backing down for a moment, you have to do it. So that's sort of what I would say is how I managed to do it and like where that sort of came from.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because, yeah, it's, I guess, about figuring out where your strengths are and not taking that strength into overdrive, figuring out, like you say, when to back off, when to push, when to do. So let's talk about that in context of the CEO role, because obviously you said, you know, we talked about it's so important to have that great comms and that relationship with the CEO. Have you always had great relationships with the CEO, or has that taken work to develop over time?
To be honest, I've always had great relationships with CEOs. It was just that one contract I was in where I really struggled, and it's because, and I think it's because they were young, and I so we probably all had egos in the room, and we were all sort of like young and didn't know what we were doing. Well, I mean, I probably had more experience on the C-suite. I knew what I was doing, but it was just, that's probably the only time I actually ever struggled with it. I'm very open about that. Like I didn't have a perfect linear career, but it was definitely important to find the businesses that worked for me as much as I worked for them. It's, I guess, in like personal relationships where you don't get on with everyone. That's just natural. But yeah, I've always gone very well with the CEOs. I honestly think with any sort of founder or CEOs or board, if they can see you care, that is the most important thing. Like if they can see that, you know, if something did hit the fan, that you would put in the time to help fix it. I think that is all that people want and need. Because if I was a founder and a CEO, that's all I would want as well. Just someone who would put the time into, and you see that actually really care about your business.
Yeah. And tell me a bit about, I guess, how you build that relationship when you go into a new organization. Because obviously you like to think that you've aced the interview and so there's a good starting point, but how do you get to that really strong CEO relationship quickly?
I would definitely outline within the first, you know, almost in your first week, sit down with the CEO and say, what do you want out of me in this amount of time? And then set expectations that way. I know when I came into this role, originally it was on a contract, and I'm permanent now because we did actually get on so well. But it was very much like, well, we've got 6 months. This is what we think we can achieve to do it. And you know, if things change and you think actually we're not going to hit that, just communicate with that. I just think it's all about managing expectations from both ends. And you have to be honest, you know, on day one, if they say we want this doing, if it's going to take longer than anticipated or it's not that easy, you have to say, okay, that's fine, but these are the obstacles we might face along the way. You have to cover your own back. And it's just about having that honest conversation. But like I say, if you can do the quick wins though at the same time, the things that don't take long, but they just help fix things. And that might be just having better sight of data or things like that, or helping them understand the business a little bit more. Little things like that will help go a long way, because at least they see you're doing something, even if you're not right now being able to tick off the big tasks they need you to do.
And what does that, you know, how much, what do you think about when you're first going into a role? Like how much due diligence do you do on a new organization before you step into it?
A lot, especially now as I've got older, because I've obviously been in businesses where I haven't enjoyed or haven't quite gone with them, or industries. I'm very lucky because I started contracting very young and I jumped around a lot at the start of my career. I've seen a lot of different industries. So I sort of know which industries I like and want to go into. So that's sort of like the first step is, would I want to work in this industry? Then it's like, how is the business performing? What are the C-suite like when you're on calls with them? That to me, because when anyone is going for an interview, never forget that you're interviewing them as much as they're interviewing you. If you don't like something or something feels off, don't go for the role, because if they like you, they will sell you to get on board. And the reality is very, very different when you get in to the role. I remember this one time I had an interview and I went for the role and I thought, this is great. And then on my first day, the CEO came and sat next to me and looked over my shoulder at what I was doing. And I personally hate stuff like that. I think, oh gosh, like, get off my back. So I'm micromanaging, you have to trust me. But obviously in the interview, they never came across that they would be like that. So it's just being aware of just being able to spot things in people's personalities and characters. One thing I love to do on interviews is ask them what they do in like their spare time, or what they enjoy doing outside of work, or why they've got to where they've got to, because then you start being able to put them together as a person and think, do I want to spend, you know, 9 hours a day with this person? Because ultimately you probably spend more time with them than you do anyone else. So it's just important to make sure you're going to get on with them well.
And, you know, what advice do you have for somebody maybe stepping up from either a finance, an FD or an FC role, and they're looking for that first CFO role? What advice would you give them?
I would say, even if you don't feel ready, just do it. I think we are our own worst sort of critics. I remember I've gone into roles thinking, oh, I don't know if I can do this role. This is way too advanced for what I am right now. But just do it and learn on the job. And don't be scared to ask questions. You know, if you go into a role and you don't know something, do not be scared to ask the CEO, well, how does this work? I don't quite understand. I mean, like when I first go into a team and a C-suite, I'm asking usually my team who I manage, well, how does this work? How do you do this? And it's dropping the ego and being like, I'm going to push myself to do this. And not be scared to ask questions and saying, oh, I don't know, but I'm going to look into that for you.
Brilliant. And so, well, thank you so much, Sophia. It's been great to understand your challenges. If people want to learn more about you and your journey, where is the best place to find you?
Definitely LinkedIn. I'm probably most social on LinkedIn than any other social platform, because I'm a complete business nerd. So yeah, definitely LinkedIn.
Brilliant. And I just want to say a massive thank you, Sophia, for taking the time to come on the podcast and share your journey. And hopefully it'll be an inspiration to others looking to take up that CFO role young as well. So thank you so much.
No, thank you. I really, really enjoyed it. And like you said, I hope it helps other people progress in their careers and get to where they want to.
Brilliant. So if you've enjoyed this episode, then of course, please do like, share, or leave us a comment on your podcast platform of choice. And if you've got further questions or follow-ups that you feel like I should have asked, then please do message me on LinkedIn. I'm always looking for inspiration and advice for the next podcast episode we do. So thanks so much for listening, guys. And we'll see you next time on the CFO 4.0 podcast.
Now, for the £1 million question. What is the best finance software for your business? Is it A, Sage 50? Is it B, Sage 200 Standard? C, Sage 200 Professional? Or D, Sage Intacct? An impossible question to answer without a lifeline. But we have the perfect lifeline for you. Our free quiz, Which Sage Product is Right for You?, will tell you which product is the best fit for your business in just 5 minutes. All you need to do is head to www.itassolutions.co.uk and answer a few simple questions.